Hi, everybody. This is Nick Fishman doing the SJV Data Solutions Hangout podcast. Today, I'm joined by Vince Brote, Vice President of Client Experience, and Kim Kerr, Mr. Everything when it comes to background screening. Kim's the founder and former CEO of Typhoon Data, former VP of Screening Solutions at LexisNexis, and the former Deputy Director of Security at the Salt Lake City Olympics Organizing Committee. His bio is much bigger than that, but those were just a few things that I pulled out. And on a personal note, probably the greatest person I've ever met in background screening. I know Vince will agree as well. If you don't know this guy, you're in for a treat. And so I hope everybody enjoys hearing from Kim today. Today, we're going to continue discussing the COVID-19 crisis. But this time, we're going to focus on how we've modeled the impact of the crisis and how it affects our business and how it will affect CRAs. We're also going to talk about plans for getting people back to work and the role medical compliance screening has taken on since this crisis began. Three different topics, but all of which I think Kim is going to be able to provide some really valuable insights on. Before we get started here, just want to remind everybody that we're all doing this from our homes. It's all on the fly. So if you hear some noises or anything like that, we apologize in advance. So far, we've been able to keep the barnyard animal sounds down, but just in case you hear something. So let's get started here. Kim, you recently walked us through an exercise to model the COVID crisis moving forward from a financial perspective. Can you talk about what you did and why?
Sure. Well, thank you for asking me to do this, Nick. It's an honor, really. There's a lot of talking heads out there, and there's, 45 economists say this, and you have 45 economists say that, and they're opposite. It's kind of comical in one way and tragic in another. So what we had to do is try to cut through the noise and not so much look forward and what we think is going to happen. But we tried to look back for a model that kind of followed the model of a worst case scenario. And for those of us now, I get joked about that I probably was around in 1918 during the Spanish flu.
Front row seats.
I was only there for the beginning and maybe the end. I don't know. But anyway, I was trying to model something where you can actually look at a model that's happened. I was not involved in the Black Plague, so I can't really go back that far. But the reality of it is we wanted to have something to say worst case scenario. Well, how could you do everything wrong? There was not a lot of medical sorts of issues that they could fall into what we have now. Really, all they fell onto was social distancing, which is kind of the cornerstone. So I looked at that in the model. It has three humps. One is the beginning, and then there's a lull. Then you have the gigantic sort of thing we're in right in the middle of now. And then you go into potentially another hump as a country. Now, I don't think it's going to be the degree, and most people don't think it's going to be the degree of the Spanish flu, but the metrics seem to be right. Now, if you overlay hiring on top of that, hiring is always the leading edge of any sort of a downturn. First thing people do is stop. They stop hiring. The next thing to do is they begin to look at layoffs potentially. That becomes a factor. And so we tried to time that and as best we could. And again, you're looking at a worst case scenario of 10 months, which was the Spanish flu end to end in terms of how it affected everything along those lines. So we look at the 10 month and then any mitigations efforts that potentially some may work, some may not. We tried to factor that in for a pessimistic, which is the Spanish flu model. Then you have the realistic, which is kind of in the middle of that, which we hope will be, likely. And then optimistic, man, this thing is going to, in 3 months, boom, we have the ability to start getting back to work. So we overlaid the hiring model on top of the worst case pessimistic, and we came up with some ideas. And we tried to at least understand how we staff and what you're going to be wanting from us, how we can best watch the flow and shift of some of the things like people are not hiring in this sector, but they're hiring over here. And that's a big deal because there has been a snap into things like, the trucking industry and the supply chain, all kinds of stuff. And then the thing where there's been major, major recession. And so we try to factor that all in. And I'm an economist by training. Doesn't mean I do it for a living, but I play one on TV. And we came up with a model we think is pretty good. And it's been run by our team, and we're going to go with that. So that's kind of the bare bones of in 10,000 words or less.
Yeah, no, I was so fascinated by the way we could take, or I shouldn't say we, that you were able to take a past event, and then we were able to look through that again as the worst case scenario and develop these three models: the pessimistic, the realistic, and the optimistic. Vince, I know you were pretty impressed and kind of wide eyed when you heard it as well. How has that applied to your decision making process or the way that you go about thinking through things now that we've modeled this out?
It's been immensely helpful. I think just like everybody else, the first couple of weeks of this, you're just in survival mode. You're trying to react to the immediacy of need for everybody. Being able to take a quick step back and look at something historical and say, okay, you know, worst case scenario, what could we be looking at? And when you combine the approach that Kim has with the daily metrics we're taking in, where we're at every day with respect to our volume and our throughput and our WIP and all the other, you know, business terms you could throw out there, we're starting to see it kind of line up. And we go, wow, the things we're seeing in our business are following this model. The things we're seeing with our customers hiring is following this model. It's allowed us the past 2 weeks to really have more informed conversations with customers. You know, are you guys modeling it this way? What are you looking at in terms of your scenario planning? How can we fit in from a help solution standpoint? It's a combination of everybody getting out of just pure reaction mode and looking ahead, and then having this model as a baseline talking point. It's really gotten to some informed conversations the past 2 weeks for sure.
Yeah, I was going to ask, since we've come up with this model, I imagine we're doing a lot of sharing with the customers as well. Are they turning that back and sharing with you? Are they saying, wow, that's an interesting model we didn't consider. Maybe we need to go at it this way. How is that?
Yeah. The responses have been pretty great. I think if you just went in with a cold opening and said, hey, what are you doing? People may, you know, sometimes there's a little bit of apprehension. We're readily sharing with people what we think, you know, what we're doing from a planning standpoint. And that kind of, you know, it opens it up a little bit more. And people are telling us, well, here's what we're seeing, or here's how far we've been down. We are seeing that a lot of businesses are planning for, as Kim would say, a second large spike or the third overall hump that could happen several months from now. You know, once social distancing ends, you get through the summer into the fall, seasonal changes, and sports are back in. There seem to be some leading indications that additional hump might occur. So being able to plan through that now is not only healthy for us, but it's super healthy for us to be talking to our clients about that. They're very receptive to that for sure.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, when we built out the model, and I do think that it can be used universally. When we built out the model, we were factoring in not only the pace at which hiring will take place or slow down, but also the pace at which courts will be reopening as well. So there's some real direct data there for how background screening companies can think about how to get work done and over what period of time it's going to take them.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So switching over to another topic, Kim, you, Vince, and I stumbled onto an interesting conversation the other day, and we were basically talking about what happens with laid off and furloughed employees when they return to the workforce. You know, at what point do employers need to consider rescreening? And I know you're not going to have the answer for exactly what that date is, but you had some interesting reactions to this. So would you mind sharing?
Sure. This is before any sort of a COVID issue, and so certainly working through the Olympics when I was working with the Olympic model, is that when you have people that are certainly in your organization, you see them on a daily basis, or you have contact with them, once you hire them, you know, there may be periodic checks or continuous monitoring that you might be doing that it's very important in certain industries. For example, if you're living in a world where all your employees are virtual or all your employees are a truck driver or some other model, continuous types of monitorings are now available. In fact, SJV obviously has one of those. But the reality of it is when you're not in that kind of a model and you're doing a hiring model, and then you're basically relying on your inner workings or your contact with individuals, there's nothing's really happening that in most cases that are not outside of your knowledge. If someone is locked up for a period of time or whatever, the big issue is that you might not know that one of your former employees or furloughed employees are in those kinds of difficulties. So they may have committed a crime in the time that they're off. Now, what is a good timeline for that? When I was doing this from a setting up policies for companies before I ever got really involved in the background screening per se, and this was when I wrote my second book on violence in the workplace, what's the issues around you want to make sure you have those kinds of things in place. And what the big thing was is that if they're out of your sight or you're out of contact with them for about 90 days, you should recheck them from the baseline. Now, if you're doing the things we recommend or what is recommended, if you furlough employees, obviously you want to check on their well-being, you want to check on how they're doing, you want to stay in contact with them. Certainly, if there's going to be an opportunity for rehire, you want to do all that sorts of, you know, the human things. But the reality is that you may not have the ability based on the size or the wherewithal of the numbers of people that you can have make those calls or contacts. It may be well to, if this thing lasts, if they're off your payroll or out of your touch or sight, you may want to consider rechecking if it's about 90 days. And why 90 days? Well, 30, 60, 90 days are oftentimes times of incarceration, time to get into the court, to get charged, all those sort of things. Anyone in the background screening world kind of knows that timeline. So I think if that's as a rule of thumb, I would recommend that. Industry differences, obviously, I don't want to make something that's going to apply in all cases, but certainly in certain industries where, again, they're not in your, you don't have contact, whatever, they come back to work, you may want to start them out with a background check so you get to that baseline again. So that's just my recommendation and based on my work and it over the years.
Yeah. Do you, Vince, I'll direct this to you. Do you see this as being a big opportunity for CRAs?
I think it can be for certain. Well, like to Kim's point, there are certain verticals or certain concentrations of industries where it's extremely applicable, where you're going to have people who go from being directly in interaction with, you know, sensitive populations or others, and they're gone for 60 to 90 days or more. And I don't want to get into what some of the major headline news estimates are for this thing, but you know, are people going to be, you know, furloughed and laid off through June? Well, you know, you go from March, April, May, June. Now you're in that 90-day period. So certainly I think it is an opportunity. And I think we mentioned it on the first podcast too, you know, just going forward and looking at, you know, alternative sources of revenue for background screening companies to try and thrive and flourish as you get through this thing. Another alternative product that you have is, hey, we can monitor on the go forward for people who are still in our custody, or we can do a quick check, a quick search backwards to see what they've done as well. You know, an isolated 90-day look back. Maybe that's a new product that's not only available now, but it's available moving forward for any other type of gap in employment.
Yeah, and by the way, and Kim, would you agree with what Vince is saying in terms of the type of product that you'd see with this?
Yeah, I think I wouldn't think in the type of express type issue. The biggest thing you're going to be concerned about, I would believe, is your identity obviously isn't going to change. Mm-hmm. But then the criminal product would be the one that I would say. And so you could have a version that just sets that a package, if you will, mm-hmm. that does for a recheck.
Yeah.
The verification of the employment may not be applicable there,
yeah.
But the two issues that I would look at, A, is doing the baseline check in terms of criminality, and then potentially looking at monitoring products on the go forward, be a good time to implement some of that type of stuff, yeah. Especially if you're in, you know, in certain industries, and again, also in medical, mm-hmm. Which is a continuous monitoring issue too.
Yeah. And so I imagine, like, when we talk about criminal, we're talking about maybe doing a current county of residence, doing another national, and then of course layering that on with the continuous monitoring just to make sure,
you know, there you go.
You've got everything that could be the trifecta. Okay. So this is where we're going to get a little bit far-fetched, but it's a conversation worth having. So I saw an article in the Wall Street Journal earlier in the week, and they were talking about how does everybody get to work? How do we get back to normal? and they highlighted Disney in Japan has reopened on a kind of controlled basis. And in order to get into the theme parks in Japan now for Disney, you need to wear a mask and you have to have your temperature taken before you can get in. Do you see a way where employers might adopt similar parameters? And I guess I'll focus this. Vince, go ahead if you don't mind.
You never know. I mean, it depends on how early they're trying to get people back to work and what areas or regions they're doing that. Areas that have become a real hotbed for this thing, you know, New York or Louisiana, parts of California, even here in Atlanta, it's still rising. We haven't reached a peak point yet. I wouldn't say definitely for sure this is going to happen, but I saw that same article and I saw others talking about, you know, why wouldn't that be something that you would see like in, you know, basketball games this summer or, mm-hmm. you know, the Hall of Fame game in August, you know, the first major football event mm-hmm. that happens. You know, why wouldn't you see something like that? I mean, there was a time when I would take a flight and I didn't have to stand in a giant clear tube with this thing circling around me, scanning my body magnetically just to get on a plane. Mm-hmm. And that's just commonplace now. And it wasn't before. So I don't think it's going to be mandatory everywhere, but I wouldn't bet against seeing it in more places than none.
So that part wasn't necessarily far-fetched, but here's where my brain started to wander, the tiny thing that I have in between my ears. So, you know, what do we think that at a certain point that employees might have to prove that they've had a vaccination or would they be tested before coming back to work to see if they have the antibodies in their system? And the reason I'm asking these questions is not only from a standpoint of could we see this happening, but could we see the background screening industry play a role in this?
Well, you got to give that little hamster in the wheel between your ears some credit. That's a good question, I think. We've seen some companies that have started up here locally that are talking about that they're going to provide, you know, the test with some sort of certification or seal, letting people know that this individual is clear. They can engage directly with people. They don't have to socially distance. I could see that being something that people may want to look at. And, you know, drug screening is a little bit different than symptom screening or disease screening. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, it's a judgment you're making about putting someone into a population based on the result of a test. Mm-hmm. Yep. So at the end of the day, there's not a huge difference there, at least in terms of just broad definitions. Maybe Kim has a different perspective on that.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, Kim, you know, Vince is being kind and not telling me I'm stupid. I know you will if you think this is a dumb question. So what do you think?
Well, there are a lot of obstacles, and the short-term nature of it is going to create some issues. It would have to be, I think there will have to be a legitimate sort of agreement industry-wise that these types of tests are not only available, but accurate. And I think where the controversy is now coming to light is there's some controversy about the whether these actually are, they say they are what they say they are. So the FDA has to certify that these tests obviously are work. And then that does that information fall under HIPAA would be a question I would have regarding that. And if those things, if someone can waive that ability to say, yeah, it's okay for my name to go into a data set, then that data set would become, would have to be contributory, I would think, to be really worth any sort of any value. So it has to have some kind of critical mass. For example, you know, what SJV is looking at is to a some sort of contributory databases and various things as a way of getting ahead of to save money over time. Well, you've got to have this issue. You got to have the critical mass for that. And if those legal windows could be, you know, you can go through those legal hurdles and get that into a data set, then I would see that would be a very valuable tool. But again, how long does that particular immunity last? That's one of the things that has not been established yet.
Right.
So that would have to be something. So I see that, you know, in principle, I think it's a possibility, but I do see that there's going to be some challenges. And how often would you have to be retested, for example, to stay in that area of being good to go.
Right. So, yeah. Well, we know, look, we're going to talk about healthcare screening. In fact, it's coming up, you know, next. Yeah. you know, for instance, if nurses and doctors, they have to get revaccinated, retested, and uploaded, you know, every year. Hopefully this is not going to be a multi-year thing, but I imagine that something similar, you know, could be done in that and in those regards. It definitely falls outside of FCRA, no doubt about it. I just wonder if there is a if there is a role for background screening companies to play.
Yeah, and I guess that's a year and a half if they're able to come a vaccine in the next year and a half. So whatever that is, if it's a large investment, could that have some kind of a application over some other type of issue? So if you go to that to build that kind of a data set, what else could it be used for at the end of that time frame? So those are things that would have to be evaluated, I think. But it's an interesting. Now I know what you do at night. You lay there and think of stuff, which is, you know, okay.
You know, listening to the Grateful Dead, watching the dancing games on my head.
Yeah, this is exciting stuff. Yikes. Okay.
He needs a hobby, Kim. He needs a hobby bad.
I do. Well, that's why I do podcasting, fellas. All right. So let's move over to medical screening. And you know, Kim, you've got a very interesting perspective here. You started Typhoon Data, which deals specifically with medical compliance. And I know that you kind of still keep your eyes and ears out for what's going on there. What are you seeing in terms of volume right now, in the healthcare industry or related industries, and the volume of the screening that they're doing right now?
Well, there's definitely an uptick. And the big thing about compliance is they've had to make some adjustments to this whole process, and it's happening on a global scale. For example, a lot of companies – not SJV, but a lot of companies use India as an example to do license checks. It's public records. And so individuals will go, and there's a lot of CAPS issues. So a lot of times those are the individuals that some of the suppliers utilize to actually get the licensing information and also then check for expiration, et cetera. And so that market's been disrupted a little bit. And so that's one of the kind of internal issues around getting the actual data on the licensing side. Just from a CRA perspective, you know, are you able to get that information quickly through your supplier, and how are they getting it, right? And so there's been some adjustments on the furnisher side. But, you know, there's also the issue around licenses. And licenses themselves, the medical industry is now coming in with some ability to extend the instead of licenses expiring, they're allowing some ability for those extensions to go out. Because, you know, if you've got people on the line, right, working a crisis like they are, for them to come off the line and, you know, update their license is a tremendous drain. So most states have been able to say, okay, your license is still in force in an extended mode, and we will come back to you at some point in time and allow you to do that particular re-end. So that's – and also the ability for bringing back people that had retired and get back into the industry to sell, to help in this issue, especially newly retired individuals. I don't know what retirement means, but if somebody actually wants to retire, there's
You do know what retirement means. It's just that Vince keeps pulling you back out of it.
Yeah, well, I know how to spell it, I guess, is my big issue. So there's the issues around. So and the boards, however, are continuing to meet. I know that there's a lot of malarkey out there that boards are meeting. You can't delay a suspension or a revocation or something. So boards are using, just like we're doing here, using electronic means to do the big stuff. Now, because of some of the agendas, they're not able to get to things like citations and fines maybe that are non-license affecting. Those things may wait. They'll circle back on that stuff. So the people that are in the medical field, they have legitimate licenses. The only change is being that they are extending them, and the boards are dealing with the big stuff. Mm-hmm. So I think the public, and we need to reassure them that the medical fraternity is still in compliance, if you will, with some minor adjustments. And they have a great organization. And we have this on our website, by the way, on our Connect site, is the Federation of State Medical Boards is actually publishing what each state is doing and we have that information for you. If you have trouble finding it, give us a call. We'll help you with that. But that tells you what states are doing, like Missouri. You know, like they're doing kind of the model I just said. They're extending those boards. So the actual demand is up. But also there's some nuances in terms of the compliance side that we have to adjust to.
But all of the data continues to remain flowing. It's just a question of what data is making it in there at that point as they prioritize what they're going to put in. Does that sound
correct?
Right?
Yeah. Correct. So if you have a medical professional that you're hiring and is a licensed taxonomy or provider type, rest assured you can get that information. That's not like it's gone offline. Boards again are meeting at the electronic level to deal with that, because that's very timely. If you had a pharmacist, as an example, that had lost their license, you would certainly want to make sure that action is taken. So that's kind of the board actions, if you will, are continuing.
Yeah.
But there will be probably a bump in the lower stuff once this thing starts to mitigate.
Yeah, so it sounds to me, too, like that is a screaming case. Not that a lot of companies aren't thinking about it or doing it anyways, but for the continuous monitoring of those sanctions,
because
system catches up, you could find all kinds of new data.
Yeah, and the frequency of that going in may be different than you're used to. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're keeping up with that. Well, you know, we have a data set that we utilize here. That's loaded every day. I mean, there's these boards come in, and that has not changed. That has not changed. Mm-hmm. The frequency of load is still there. So, you know, that's an important product for us. And we feel that's really cutting edge in terms of making sure it really is. The word continuous is used a lot. And this is really, like our criminal product, are really continuous. And that stuff is being loaded daily still.
Yeah, and of course I'll try and plug SJV, but I know that doesn't happen with every medical sanction search out there. Sometimes you're waiting weeks for the information to come in, correct?
Well, I think the big issue is that the periodic batching, which is kind of the 1998 model, is now, you know, now we have a more nimble sort of technology that should be, you know, at least looked at. Because you don't want a pharmacist to be checked on the first, and on the second they lose their license or license revocation, and they're writing scripts, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in this model, I did, by the way, cough into my elbow just then.
That was impressive.
Yeah,
that was good.
Thank you.
So you touched on it, and actually, I wanted to ask you about all of the health workers that are coming back from retirement, or whatnot. And that was a question, like, I think I read a New York Times article, if I'm not mistaken, it was from New York for sure, that last month over 1,000 former caregivers came back onto the front lines in order to do
that. Oh, wow. It's impressive.
Yeah. So any sense of, do you think that they are being screened or had to be rescreened in order to come back in, or they're just opening up the floodgates?
No, I think probably most of them, they may have checked their licenses, you know, so they would be not invited. But most medical professionals, even after retirement, will often keep their license, you know, current. Mm-hmm. It's something if they ever decide to work in the medical field after a period of time is maybe a part-time, that sort of thing. So licenses normally don't end the minute you retire. So I think that most licenses, if they did the check, would be found to be valid. And unless they were really reaching back many, many years and so forth. But I think more of what their focus was, as I interpreted and heard it and read it, was that they were trying to get recently retired or people that recently left the medical field.
Cool. Vince, what are you seeing in terms of demand from CRAs for this? I mean, obviously, if they didn't have big healthcare client base, they probably are not as interested, but I got to imagine you've got a number of clients that have a big healthcare focus. What are you hearing from them on this?
We did. The first thing we saw was to Kim's point, there were some new batches that got loaded right away, right from the jump, sizable ones. Hey, we've got a big group. We're either rescreening that hasn't been around. We've got a bunch of people who were just, you know, coming through that we want to make sure we're getting them all done all at once. And there was a big initial spike with that. there are some ongoing conversations we've been having with folks about what are they going to be doing beyond this? So you're getting all these people who are coming back and you're rescreening them and the initial check is good. This is lasting longer than 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. That seems to be the recurring soundbite in this podcast. So having something that can, you know, benchmark them initially and then keep them, you know, in the clear continuously over time. Those are the conversations we're having is how do you get these people into this screening population, you know, quickly identified as good? And then now what do we do? I think there's a lot of opportunities for CRAs who have not traditionally been active in healthcare screening are, you know, for lack of a better word, they're taking advantage of this opportunity to learn it and to act on it.
Yep. Okay. Thanks. Kim, I'm directing this question to you and only to you. Vince, you are not allowed to answer. I got in trouble the last time. I got in trouble the last time I asked this question without knowing the answer to both Scott and Vince. But what am I missing on healthcare in medical compliance screening that I haven't asked? Are there other topics that we should be talking about here today?
I guess the biggest thing is that in terms of is completeness. I think oftentimes when we think about medical screening, we think about the minimal aspect of the officer inspector general, the OIG searches and so forth, which is your minimal. But there's so many, which always concerns me in situations like this, where there's a lot of grabbing of people. They need people that have lost, say, their doctor's license in this state, and they go out and they test for potentially in another state. They try to get it on through some other type of medical issue. So I think if you know, skipping over some of this stuff is where you don't check board actions from other states, as an example. You just check the state or the OIG. Medical data is a bubble up. It's not a bubble down. It doesn't start at the OIG and bubble down into the lower board actions and so forth. It bubbles up. That's really where it starts. And then it goes up to the states and eventually it gets to the OIG. So that timeline is not really understood in some cases, where they don't realize it feeds up instead of down. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I think people kind of go on the cheap, and I think you're inheriting risk.
Yeah.
Because they could have been never done something that happened that raised the level of an OIG offense, mm-hmm. but they could have been involved in some stuff that really your customer may not really want to have in their organization that comes in the form of board actions.
Right. Okay. That makes sense. So, you know, absolute minimum effort is the OIG. But in addition to like, okay, fine, you're going to, that's the cheapest product you can find. There are real implications for keeping healthcare professionals on the payroll when there are things that they should have known were out there. I think it's what, $10,000 a day per individual.
Oh yeah. It's huge. I mean, I can't tell you the name of this particular chain, which I did work for after the fact, but it was, you know, they had two unlicensed pharmacists and up in a, you know, kind of a smaller area in the Midwest, and they were given a, you know, $10 million fine, and they were only unlicensed for a very short period of time. That was the settlement. Mm-hmm. It could have been $10,000 per prescription or some incredible amount. So they settled for a pretty big amount, and they self-disclosed. So it's, you know, FCR, you know, it's $1,000 and all that kind of stuff in the FCRA world, but medical fines are huge, especially if the OIG catches you.
Yeah.
So it can be a huge financial impact.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. All right. Well, I think we've covered a lot of territory here today. I want to thank both of you guys for taking the time to do this. If our interested, our listeners rather, are interested in learning more about SJV, more than welcome to find us at www.sjvdata.com. We'll see you again for the next podcast coming up soon. Have a great day, everybody.